This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we interview Stephen Rohde, a constitutional scholar, to explain to us what the radical right-wing Supreme Court did this term and what it means for the future.
Well, it's a question of power, isn't it? And this court has taken over doing what it can do because it has the power to do it. Listen in. We're speaking today with Elliot Nagin from the Union of Concerned Scientists about a pernicious group called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council.
Many people have never heard of ALEC, but it functions as a dangerous shadow government to get repressive legislation enacted.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. During its last term, the Supreme Court demonstrated that it is the most right-wing court since 1931. In cases involving reproductive rights, entanglement of church and state, the right to carry guns, and the ability of congressionally mandated administrative agencies to regulate climate change, the High Court's conservative members handed down reactionary rulings. The court has agreed to hear a case next term that could radically change our electoral system. To help us understand what the Supreme Court has done and where it is headed, we are joined by Stephen Rohde. Steve is an author and social justice advocate who practiced civil rights and constitutional law for over 45 years, including representing two men on California's death row. He is the former chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California and former national chair of Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice. He is also a board member of Death Penalty Focus. Stephen Rohde, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you guys for having me on such an important topic.
Steve, in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Association, the right-wing majority of the Supreme Court held that there is no constitutional right to abortion because abortion is not deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition and implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. Please explain to our listeners what this ruling could mean for other privacy rights that we hold dear.
Well, Dobbs is probably the most well-known of these decisions that the Supreme Court recently made. I've been studying the Supreme Court for decades, writing about it, practicing civil rights law. This is easily one of the most terrifying terms of the United States Supreme Court in my lifetime. And I believe historically, with so many decisions that go against settled constitutional principles, this could be the worst set of decisions in the history of a court, which has had very dark times in the past with terrible decisions. What the conservative, and I'm going to sometimes use the word conservative, I believe it's really arch-conservative or reactionary to call them that. What they did is they elevated four constituencies that they are serving, and I'm speaking of the six arch-conservative members of the court. They're serving an interest that got them nominated and got them approved. These are the interests of pro-business, anti-abortion, pro-gun, and Christian nationalism. And this is the triumph of these interests, using a doctrine called originalism in order to install their political decisions. So in Dobbs, they did exactly that. They threw out a 50-year-old precedent in Roe v. Wade, which 20 years later was reinforced by a case called Casey. 20 times the Supreme Court has reaffirmed that the right to an abortion, the right of reproductive freedom, is embedded in the exact term called liberty in the 14th Amendment. Originalism is a very convenient approach. It was really can be traced back to Robert Bork in a Law Review article published in 1971. It was then picked up by Supreme Court justices such as Antonin Scalia, and now it controls the U.S. Supreme Court as the only method. They will look to the intention sometimes, or at least the expression and beliefs of the founders who wrote the Constitution in 1789, or to those who ratified the 14th Amendment in 1868. And it's very simple. They look back then, and if a right was not protected in those eras of American history, that right is not protected today. The opposing view was best articulated by Justice William Brennan in a powerful talk he gave in 1985, where he nailed the originalism as arrogance clothed in humility. These arch-conservatives are saying, oh, all we're doing is following the founders, when in fact they're using a recent theory which obliterates the development of constitutional law over decades. This ruling in Dobbs, by the words of Justice Clarence Thomas, could overturn the right to use contraception, the right to intimate same-sex relationships, and same-sex marriage. All of those are now on the chopping block as a result of this decision.
Now let's talk religion, Steve. Briefly describe, please, the court's decisions in the two major cases involving religious rights, Carson versus Macon and Kennedy versus Bremerton. Do you think that there is much of a wall left between church and state after these two rulings?
I don't. The First Amendment, the founders were intelligent and expressly included the fact that Congress shall make no law establishing religion, but it also protected the exercise of religion, and that was carried to the states through the 14th Amendment. In Carson versus Macon, a 6-3 decision, the state of Maine has many rural areas that don't have public schools. So other counties were subsidizing public schools, and the state of Maine, for some reason, decided to include private schools in that tuition subsidy. Well, a group of Christian nationalist lawyers and parties came along, and now the Supreme Court has held that if you fund public schools and private schools, you also have to fund religious schools. This is a direct assault. It was exactly what Madison and Jefferson worried about, was the use of taxpayer money to underwrite and support religion, and in this case, religious education. And to get there, they overturned a major precedent, and it's devastating to separation of church and state. In another aspect, in Kennedy, they upheld the right of a public school coach who was an employee of a public school in Bremerton to pray at the end of football games at the 50-yard line. Often he gathered his students together. The dissenting opinion accused the conservative majority of not stating the facts honestly and accurately. So Justice Sotomayor included photographs of the students praying with the coach at the 50-yard line, a direct endorsement of religion, allowing public school time, salary, and facilities being used to lift up religious prayers. Both of these cases are sinister attacks on separation of church and state, and I can only imagine what's yet to come.
You know, Steve, I'd love to see the Supreme Court protecting the right of Muslims to put their prayer rug down on the 50-yard line after a football game. moving along, in West Virginia versus EPA, the court came down on the side of coal companies and Republican-led states to restrain the EPA's power to regulate carbon emissions. What does this decision mean for the ability of other federal agencies to protect our health and safety?
This decision, West Virginia versus EPA, furthers the value I mentioned at the beginning. This is a pro-business court. These justices and the Federalist Society that got them appointed for decades has wanted to cut back on federal regulations of clean air and clean water, and now they have found a way to undermine the EPA in a facile decision which says that Congress never intended to give these powers to this administrative agency within the executive branch. It is an opinion written by Justice Gorsuch, one of three Trump nominees, and I'll use this moment to point out that this 6-3 majority comes about because of three justices who made various promises at their hearings in which I believe they lied to Congress and the American people. This case of West Virginia versus EPA poses a threat to the entire creation of administrative agencies in the post-New Deal or New Deal and post-New Deal periods meant to protect the American people against pollution and other adverse commercial and business interests. And this one is going to be cited repeatedly in the future as this conservative majority dismantles these kinds of protections.
Steve, please explain what the court held in New York State Rifle versus Bruin. After this ruling, can you think of any gun regulations that the court would allow?
This case is such an elevation of hypocrisy by this court. In New York State Rifle versus Bruin, a century-old law in New York State required the licensing of an individual if they intended to have a concealed weapon in public. And the issue in the license was simply they needed to give a proper reason. Why did they need to carry a concealed weapon in public? What was the nature of their work, their life, their geographical location, or any other simple reason? This court held in a 6-3 decision that being asked to give a reason for carrying a concealed weapon in public violated the Second Amendment to the Constitution, which speaks of the need for a well-regulated militia and the right to bear arms. This case serves the pro-gun lobby that has gotten these justices appointed and is in the grip of the NRA and likewise the Republican Party. The notion, even earlier cases by Justice Scalia said that the Second Amendment allowed for reasonable regulation of guns, even if an individual right to own a gun was protected by the Second Amendment, which is largely disputed. To get to this result, now all of a sudden, the court said that we need to look at future developments in the law, and they sounded like the dissent in Dobbs as they reiterated how times change and how various needs for guns can change. And they cast originalism in their favor to uphold the right to bear arms without these normal, simple regulations. It's a very dangerous ruling. It will lead to striking down all kinds of reasonable gun safety regulations across the country.
We're talking with Steve Rohde on the current court decisions. This is Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host, Marjorie Cohn. Steve, the court has agreed to hear a North Carolina case next term that could give state legislatures independent power to set election rules that conflict with state constitutions. Those rules would not be subject to review by state courts, and how could that case affect our electoral system? Could the Supreme Court put itself in the position of influencing presidential elections?
It certainly could, and I think that's the entire intention of accepting this North Carolina case. This case is going to require all of us to understand the independent state legislature theory, which is one theory interpreting the election clause of the U.S. Constitution. Now, we first had a hint of the elevation of this theory to control federal elections when Rehnquist and others identified it in Bush v. Gore, equally one of the most ignominious cases this conservative court 20 years ago decided. So what you have in Moore versus Harbor is an effort to upend election laws across the country with the potential endorsement of this fringe theory about how much power state legislatures have over the running of congressional and presidential elections. So there were newly drawn maps that the Republican state legislature in North Carolina put in place, and their state court overturned that map, and a state-drawn map was put in place instead for this year's midterm election. This case has now been brought to the United States Supreme Court in an attempt to say that state legislatures have the power to determine how congressional elections are conducted without any checks and balances from their state constitution or state courts. This upends all kinds of principles that conservatives have previously elevated, such as independent state courts and their state constitution. We already have a preview that in March, the Republicans tried to get an emergency request to stop this map from being used. Fortunately, the court overall rejected that, but Justices Samuel Alito, Gorsuch, and Thomas signaled that they are likely to side with the Republican lawmakers. And when this case is fully argued and briefed, if they can get two more justices out of three conservatives, they could alter the next presidential election in 2024.
Well, Steve, that is not a pretty picture, but we have our work cut out for us. How can our listeners follow your work?
Well, most of my writing is at the Los Angeles Review of Books. You can simply go to the Los Angeles Review of Books, and I am a contributor there. I'm always eager to speak with your listeners. My email is rohdevictr@aol.com. I think this is a time for all of us to react to these decisions in the short term to ensure reproductive rights and reproductive freedom in every state on federal property through laws that protect the right to an abortion. But it's very clear that the conservatives see the Supreme Court as an arm of politics. And if that's true, then it is elections that are going to decide who is in the Senate, what presidents appoint Supreme Court justices. It will take generations to turn this court around, but there is no more important work facing the American people.
Well stated, Steve. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder, and Marjorie and I look forward to having you back on again soon.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you both.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Days makes no difference to me, babe. You look exactly the same to me. There ain't no time crossing your legs inside the diner, raising the coffee to your lips. esteem. You saw the masterpiece. She looks a lot like you. Wrapping her left arm around your leg, ready to walk you through. You whisper to a restless ear, can you get me out of here? This place smells like Denver.
The United States underwent a public interest revolution in the 1960s and early 1970s. In the first half of the 60s, Congress passed precedent-setting environmental laws, including the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and the Water Quality Act. And in just 3 years, from 1969 to 1972, the federal government adopted a raft of new environmental, public health, workplace, and consumer protection, and established new agencies to administer them, including the Environmental Protection Agency and the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. That revolution sparked a counter-revolution that is still reverberating today. Wealthy conservatives, corporations, and libertarian foundations poured money into new think tanks and advocacy groups, including the Heritage Foundation and the Charles Koch Cato Institute. A less well-known group, the American Legislative Exchange Council, was founded around the same time. It goes by the acronym ALEC. Unlike the Heritage and Cato, ALEC, a network of nearly 300 corporations, trade groups, law firms, and libertarian foundations, operates at the state level. The group provides state legislatures with a variety of ready-made bills that, among other things, roll back voting rights, thwart efforts to address climate change, and bolster corporate profits. State lawmakers introduced nearly 2,900 bills based on Alex's recommendations from 2010 through 2018, according to the investigation by the USA Today, the Arizona Republic, and the Center for Public Integrity. More than 600 of these bills became law. Lately, Alec has been coaching state legislatures on how to spin the recent Supreme Court decision overturning Roe v. Wade. Alec has been working behind the scenes to amplify the false GOP narrative of voter fraud. Writer Elliot Negren has been following Alec off and on for the last decade, and he recently posted an essay that explains in detail how Alec turns disinformation into law. We are fortunate to have Elliot as our guest. Elliot is a senior writer at the Union of Concerned Scientists, a national science advocacy organization. Prior to joining UCS in 2007, he was the Washington Communications Director for the Natural Resource Defense Council, a former news editor at National Public Radio, the managing editor of American Journalism Review, and the editor of Nuclear Times and Public Citizen magazines. Elliot, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good to be here.
Elliot, why did you become interested in researching and writing about the American Legislative Exchange Council, and what are Alex's guiding principles?
Well, I first became aware of ALEC about 10 years ago. The organization had been operating under the radar for decades. I mean, it started in 1973. But in 2011, the Center for Media and Democracy, it's an advocacy group based in Madison, Wisconsin, obtained internal ALEC documents from a whistleblower and posted them on its website. And that was the first inkling we had. I mean, I'd heard of the organization, but it was they had voluminous materials from the organization they were able to post, which opened a lot of people's eyes to what ALEC was all about. But what really outed ALEC within about a year later was the coverage of the, you remember, the controversy over the Stand Your Ground laws in the wake of the February 2012 murder of Trayvon Martin in Florida. And ALEC was working with the National Rifle Association and drafted a sample bill based on the Florida self-defense law, and more than 30 states ultimately adopted that law. So there were a spate of news stories on the Stand Your Ground laws that pointed out that ALEC was not only behind that law, but also had been ghostwriting state bills on a wide range of issues, you know, from voter ID laws to worker protections, undermining worker protections, that is. But the stories didn't mention ALEC's efforts to block state and efforts to address climate change. So I wrote a piece for the Huffington Post focusing on that back in 2012. As far as ALEC's guiding principles, ALEC is fundamentally a libertarian organization. On its website, it states that it promotes what it calls Jeffersonian principles of free markets, limited government, federalism, and individual liberty. That might sound a little like gobbledygook, but if you want to translate into English, this is what it means. By free markets, ALEC means giving free rein to corporations by rolling back public health, environmental, consumer, and voting protections. And by limited government, ALEC means radically downsizing the federal government. And by federalism, it means transferring authority from the federal government to governors and state legislatures, which corporations can manipulate more easily. Essentially, ALEC wants corporations to dictate public policy.
Elliot, who formed and finances ALEC, and what specifically does ALEC do?
Okay, well, ALEC, as I mentioned earlier, was founded back in 1973, and as you pointed out in your intro, it was part of a counter-revolution by the business community to try to roll back all the consumer, public health, environmental, workplace protections that were put in place in the early 1970s. And it was founded in 1973 by a Republican U.S. House member from Illinois named Henry Hyde, who went on to become a senator after that. And Hyde was working with a couple of right-wing activists, including a man named Paul Weyrich. And Paul Weyrich played a seminal role in this counter-revolution. He also co-founded the Heritage Foundation that same year, 1973. And the goal of ALEC at the time, and still the goal of ALEC, is to promote a conservative agenda at the state level. As far as who finances ALEC, it's largely financed by corporations and libertarian foundations. And its budget in 2020, that's the last tax forms we can get a hold of, was nearly $8 million. And about a half dozen libertarian foundations, including the Lind and Harry Bradley Foundation, the Adolf Coors Foundation, that's the Coors beer money, and foundations controlled by billionaire industrialist Charles Koch, were responsible for about 60% of the contributions to ALEC between 2014 and 2019. Essentially what ALEC yes. does, it provides state lawmakers with ready-made, fill-in-the-blank sample legislation that's drafted by or on behalf of ALEC's corporate and foundation members. So it functions as a conduit which allows corporate lobbyists to essentially write legislation, sample legislation, that they hand out to their lawmaker members who then turn around and introduce it in their state houses.
Tell us who the members of ALEC are, please.
Well, according to ALEC's website, Its members include about 2,000 state legislators, state officials, and state staff employees. And those folks pay a token fee of about $200 for a two-year membership. That's the lawmaker side of the membership. The corporate side includes nearly 300 companies, trade groups, corporate law firms, and foundations that pay annual dues of $12,000 to $25,000. And it will cost these corporate members an additional $5,000 to participate in an ALEC task force where the corporate and lawmaker members draft these sample bills behind closed doors. And it can also cost corporations as much as $40,000 to sponsor an ALEC conference session. Of the 300 companies, it would take me all day to list them all here, but some of the major corporate members include the Altria Group, which used to be called Philip Morris, the tobacco company, the American Electric Power Company, Anheuser-Busch, Chevron, Duke Energy, Eli Lilly, Farmers Insurance, FedEx, Koch Industries, which is owned by Charles Koch, Marathon Oil, Pfizer, and UPS. It's all across the board. They've got corporate members in all sectors.
Very interesting, Elliot. How does ALEC operate? Talk about the legislative templates it creates and what that process is, please. Can you describe ALEC's use of disinformation and hiding its track record from the public?
Sure. Well, when it comes to legislation, ALEC provides state legislators with these sample bills where they can fill in the blanks for their own states. And ALEC will give these bills, these sample bills, deceptive titles and descriptions, which exploits the fact that lawmakers and even lawmakers who sponsor the bills themselves, they don't often bother to read the actual text of a bill because they're just so busy. And even when they do take time to read the bills based on ALEC's templates, ALEC uses draft language that is purposely unremarkable or technical to obscure their impact. One of the examples I mentioned in my recent article on ALEC was a sample bill called the Asbestos Claims Transparency Act. Lawmakers have introduced that bill in at least 17 states between 2012 and 2018, and at least 11 legislators enacted it. And despite its title, the bill doesn't require companies to disclose information about products containing asbestos or let those people who've been exposed to this cancer-causing material, it doesn't give them any information how to get help or seek compensation. In fact, what the bill does is limits the public's ability to sue asbestos manufacturers for damages. So the title itself is incredibly deceptive. Second, what ALEC does to promote its agenda to indoctrinate or just mislead state lawmakers, ALEC provides these lawmakers with a steady stream of seemingly independent, neutral experts who are in fact representing special interests. So in the case of the bill I just mentioned, some of the folks who were traveling around the country meeting with legislators were representing surreptitiously representing the company's interests who manufactured asbestos, unbeknownst to the lawmakers.
For those of our listeners who've just tuned in, I'm Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Marjorie Cohn, and we're speaking with Elliot Nagin, who is an expert on the American Legislative Exchange Council called ALEC. Elliot spells his name with two L's and two T's. It's Nagin, N-E-G-I-N. For those of you who'd like to Google him, he's written several articles, including a recent one on ALEC, which is a real pernicious instrument in the hands of the bad guys in this country. Elliot, what has ALEC accomplished since its formation in 1973? In particular, what has it done to frustrate climate activists?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, more than 30 states have enacted bills based on ALEC's Stand Your Ground self-defense bill, and at least 11 state legislators passed ALEC's Asbestos Claims Transparency Act, and those are just two examples of the more than 600 ALEC-drafted bills state legislators enacted from 2010 through 2018. And when it comes to foiling efforts to address climate change, ALEC is ALEC has convinced state lawmakers to sponsor bills that would discourage consumers from buying electric vehicles, bills that would undermine government oversight on fracking, and bills that would pull their states out of regional cap-and-trade climate pacts. One example I can give you is that in 2019, Consumer Reports posted an investigation where it found that legislators in 26 states had enacted or proposed special registration fees for electric vehicles that are more expensive than the gas taxes paid by owners of average new gasoline vehicles. And it turned out that the template for these so-called equal tax treatment for all vehicles bills was ALEC, working hand-in-hand with advocacy groups funded by Charles Koch, who has a vested interest in stopping the adoption of electric vehicles because his company makes a lot of money on refining oil, and he owns thousands of miles of oil pipelines.
It sounds like ALEC is a dangerous shadow government. What about its activities in restricting our right to vote?
Well, ALEC has been playing a behind-the-scenes role in the voter suppression movement for quite a while. Its anti-democratic efforts began at least a decade ago when it promoted a discriminatory voter ID law. More recently, in 2019, in the run-up to the 2020 election, ALEC set up a secret working group to address redistricting, ballot measures, and election law. And by the spring of 2021, more than 100 ALEC lawmakers in six battleground states, including Arizona, Georgia, and Pennsylvania, were sponsoring or co-sponsoring bills to make it harder for college students, people with disabilities, and black and brown citizens to vote. ALEC is also working with the Heritage Action for America, which is the political arm of the Heritage Foundation, on a $24 million campaign to lobby lawmakers in at least eight states, including Arizona, Florida, Georgia, and Michigan, to pass tighter voting restrictions.
We're speaking with Elliot Nagin. Elliot, what is the reason ALEC concentrates on influencing state legislatures and governors? Are they an easier target than appealing to voters?
Well, states are prime targets because it's easier for corporations to get what they want from state legislators than Congress. And the biggest problem is state lawmakers have limited time, meager salaries in general, and resources. They want to introduce bills to do their job, but when they don't have a staff or have a very small one, ALEC provides them with a shortcut by providing these ready-made bills. Now, a lot of people don't know a whole lot about state governments, maybe they don't know a lot about their own state government, but many state legislators are part-time, and they don't pay lawmakers full-time salaries. So, and legislators in Montana, Nevada, North Dakota, and Texas, for example, are in session every other year. So many legislators have to have outside jobs and don't have a lot of time to put into legislating. And that makes them dependent on outside sources like ALEC. ALEC exploits that problem. And given ALEC's political bias, it also takes advantage of the fact that Republicans now control more state houses than Democrats. In 1980, Democrats controlled 29 state houses, while Republicans controlled only 15. But after the 2020 election, those numbers were nearly reversed. Republicans now control 30 state legislatures, while Democrats hold only 18. And nearly all of the 2,000 members of ALEC are Republican.
Elliot, how many Congress members, senators, state legislators, and governors are under the sway of ALEC? Please talk about their numbers in Congress and in state legislatures.
Republicans now control 30 state legislatures, which makes it easier for ALEC to ply its trade. One thing you have to consider is ALEC is a very secretive group. It doesn't publish a complete list of its self-reported 2,000 members. But public interest groups have been able to compile a list based on leaked documents and various ALEC announcements about its leadership and its task force members. The Center for Media and Democracy, which is the group that blew the whistle on ALEC back in 2011, set up a website called ALEC Exposed, and it's probably the best place to find out which state legislators are ALEC members. Currently, ALEC's website lists six governors who were ALEC members, including Brian Kemp in Georgia, Kay Ivey in Alabama, and Kristi Noem in South Dakota. In ALEC Exposed, the website from the Center for Media and Democracy lists 13 former governors with ALEC ties, including Nikki Haley from South Carolina, John Kasich from Ohio, Rick Perry from Texas, and Scott Walker from Wisconsin. There are a number of ALEC alumni also in Congress today. There are 13 former ALEC members, including Lindsey Graham, James Inhofe, and Marco Rubio in the Senate. And one Democratic outlier, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, also was an ALEC member. He was one of the few Democratic members of ALEC. In the House, right now, there are 64 former ALEC members, including Andy Biggs from Arizona and Andy Harris from Maryland, who were in the group of House members who met with President Trump in December 2020 to plan to overturn the election results. There's a high percentage of ALEC alumni in Congress who are doing what they can to stop Congress from doing anything about climate change. And more than 60% of the ones that are listed, there's all told 77, are climate science deniers. And the organization's alumni at Capitol Hill are also apparently committed to undermining democracy. More than half of the 77 of them in Congress were among the 147 Republicans who voted to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. So ALEC and its influence on the state houses is a crucible for representatives and senators and governors who go on after they spend time in state legislatures and continue to push ALEC's agenda.
Why should Americans be concerned about ALEC? You've just discussed that, but I wanted you to describe more in particular the danger of a corporatocracy about which you have written, a corporatocracy.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's pretty self-explanatory. Our democracy is distorted when corporations exert undue influence over elected officials, and ALEC is just one manifestation of a much larger problem. It doesn't work independently. It works hand in hand with a network, the state policy network. There are many heritage foundations in each state, and they all work at the state level with ALEC to promote libertarian ideas of dismantling and undermining state governments. So it's a long-term problem, and you know it's sort of similar to what had just happened with the Supreme Court overturning Roe versus Wade. This is a 50-year campaign on a range of sectors where the right wing has been working diligently for 4 or 5 decades to overturn the progress that was made up to that point.
Elliot, what success have advocacy groups had in exposing ALEC's frightening actions to the sunshine of public opinion? Have there been many dropouts from ALEC's membership roles?
Well, ever since we finally found out about ALEC's activities back 10 years ago or so, there's been a lot of pressure coming from shareholders, unions, and public interest groups, as well as news coverage. And because of the light that's being shined on ALEC over the last 10 years, more than 100 corporate and nearly 20 trade association and foundation members canceled their memberships since 2012. Likewise, ALEC's annual revenue dropped nearly 25% between 2017 and 2020, from a high of a little more than $10 million to just under $8 million in 2020. So it's been losing revenue at least over the last 5 years, and more than 120 corporate members have canceled their memberships. The corporations that have quit ALEC over the last decade include some real heavy hitters: Amazon, AT&T, Bank of America, Dow Chemical, Facebook, General Electric, General Motors, I could go on, and even major oil and gas companies, which have been benefiting from Alec's agenda to undermine environmental protections. Even BP America, Exxon, and Shell finally walked away from Alec. That said, there's still, you know, 300 members on the corporate side who are still hanging in with Alec.
Elliot, why do you think these big corporations have been defecting from Alec?
Well, there have been more and more companies that have come to realize climate change is real and they need to do something about it. A lot of them don't want to be tarred by their membership with Alec. There were a number of defectors who left after the big controversy over the Stand Your Ground laws 10 years ago. And then over the last 10 years, there's been a steady exodus. It just doesn't look good for corporations to be associated with the group. By the same token, these corporations could very well be still funding these legislators through campaign contributions. So they have other ways to get what they want.
Elliot, unfortunately, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time. Folks, we've been talking with Elliot Negin, N-E-G-I-N. Elliot, let me just ask you as a final question. How can listeners get involved in opposing Alec, and how can they get access to your excellent articles?
Well, first of all, unfortunately, most Americans don't pay close attention to what's going on in their state houses, and that's a problem. They need to pay more attention to what's going on, and unfortunately, there are fewer and fewer newspapers, and newspapers have been failing right and left. So there's not a whole lot of information. There's not as much information as there was years ago. But what they can do is support the groups that are watchdogging Alec, and those include the Center for Constitutional Rights, the Center for Media and Democracy, Color of Change, Common Cause, Documented, Stand Up to Alec, and True North Research. And Common Cause has state chapters, so they could get involved with one of them, which are probably looking very closely at their state houses. And for more general information, they can go to the Union of Concerned Scientists website and check out a guide we published recently called What You Can Do About Disinformation. And their website address is www.ucsusa.org. As far as finding my work, if they could just Google my name, last name is N-E-G-I-N, on the internet, and they'll find my latest columns.
Great, Elliot. You've been a terrific guest. We're so glad to have you on Law and Disorder. We thank you very much for your good work, and we'll keep checking in with you because I think this is a permanent problem in our democracy. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks, Elliot.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Law and Disorder has been broadcasting for nearly 13 years now. We started on WBAI in New York City and are now carried on nearly 100 affiliate stations across the country. We'd like to take a moment to thank them.
WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. KRFP 90.3 FM, Radio Free Moscow, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN 107.5 FM, Nashville, Tennessee. KSOW 106.7 FM, Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP 101.7 FM, Clay, West Virginia.
KRFC 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD 90.7 FM, Kasilof, 104.5 FM radio, Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJLP, 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts.
K
KEIF-FM, 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. WPVM, 103.9 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago. Motion Community House Radio, online.
WLRI 92.9 FM, Gap, Pennsylvania. WPRR 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS 102.1 FM, Columbus Community Radio. 98.3 FM, Central Ohio. KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, WSLR-FM 96.5, Sarasota, Florida, KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Around Radio, Lorain Community College Radio, WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut,
WJFF Radio Catskill 90.5 FM, WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin.
That's where I used to go fishing with Michael Ratner.
WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine, 99.9 FM, Bangor, Maine, Redwood Community Radio.
KMUD 91.1 FM, Garberville, California. KMUE 88.3 FM, Eureka, California. KLAI 90.3 FM, Laytonville, California. Voice of Sacramento 88.7 FM, Sacramento Community Radio.
WWPM MediaNet, Nokomis, Illinois. Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass., where I grew up. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass., where I did three semesters.
You dropped out.
KSER FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington. WCRS, LPFM, 98.3 FM and 102.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ, 94.9 FM, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU, 90.7 FM.
WGCX, 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. WGCX, 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR, 91.7 FM, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS 92.3 FM and 89.9 FM, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, The I, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Massachusetts. WFTE 90.3 FM and 105.7 FM, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. Rochester Free Radio, WRFI 91.9 FM, Watkins Glen. WINO 89.9 FM, Odessa, and 88.1 FM, Ithaca, New York. WEFT 90.1 FM, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix, online community radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio, Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes. KAOS 89.3 FM, Olympia, Washington. KWTF, Sonoma County, California.
Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas. KBOO 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Portland. 100.7 FM, Corvallis. 91.9 FM, Hood River. WSCA 106.1 FM, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. WZRD 88.3 FM, Chicago, Illinois.
KOWA 106.5 FM, Olympia, Washington. WRIR 97.3, Richmond, Virginia. KMEC 105.1 FM, Ukiah, California. KSVU 90.1 FM, Concrete, Washington. WXPI 88.5 FM, Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
KNSJ 89.1 FM, San Diego, California. KGHI 91.1 FM, Westport, Washington. Our streaming planet podcast, WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C. KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas. 89.7 FM, Huntsville, Texas. 89.5 FM, Galveston, Texas. WOOL FM, 91.5 FM, Bellow Falls, Vermont. Black Sheep Radio.
KGIG 104.9 FM, Salida, California. KEUL 88.9 FM, Girdwood, Alaska. KRDILP 103.1 FM, Duval, Washington. WUMD 89.3 FM, University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. KWRKLP 90.9 FM, Alaska Peace Center, Fairbanks, Alaska.
WGRN LP 94.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York. WHYR LP 96.9 FM, Baton Rouge Community Radio, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Workforce Rising online. KBFG 107.3, Seattle, Washington, and KKRN 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
And we'd like to extend a special thanks to KNSG 89.1 FM in San Diego, as well as KGHI 99.1 FM in Westport, Washington.
WMNB LP 107.1 FM, North Adams, Massachusetts.
KODX LP 96.9 FM, Seattle, Washington.
KKRN 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
KBFG 107.3 FM, Seattle, Washington.
WEJP LP 107.1 FM, Wheeling, West Virginia.
That's on Mondays at 7 a.m. and Friday at 7 p.m. And finally, the Progressive Radio Network on Wednesdays at 5 p.m. If you're not on this list and would like to be, please contact lawanddisorder.org, our producer Jeff Brady, so we can count you among our growing list of stations, and we'll notify you of upcoming programs and specials. Thank you.